out process. But today, Jacksonville moves forward with new names for local schools. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a closer look at the decision to rename six Duval County public schools and leave the legacy of the Confederacy behind. Finally, the number to join us, 549-2937. Then later, we'll tell you about new efforts in the city to fight the opioid epidemic. First, though, here's your COVID update for Wednesday. The state reported 5,937 new cases overnight and 95 new deaths. Here's another number. As of Tuesday, 8.3 million Florida residents have been fully vaccinated with the coronavirus jab. So people, go get your shot, please. We say it every morning. People continue to die every single day from this virus, and those deaths will diminish and stop if we can all get vaccinated. Well, here's our top story for the morning. It is now official. Local school names with ties to the Confederacy are gone. Tuesday night, the Duval County School Board voted to rename six schools in Jacksonville, including Lee High School. The vote came after an intense process that's involved big parts of the community and has taken nearly a year. We're going to take a closer look now as we welcome Rachel Tutwiler-Fortune, Executive Vice President of JaxPEF, the Jacksonville Public Education Fund. Rachel, so good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What's your reaction to the vote to rename six local schools with Confederate ties? 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we're already getting your Facebook comments. Well, Rachel, JaxPEF has been talking about this for some time. So this was not an unexpected vote. That said, what's your reaction to the news?
Well, as you already mentioned, Melissa, last night was the final step in the school renaming process. And we're very proud that the school board did decide to move forward with new names for the schools who are named after Confederate leaders in our community. As a person who's grown up here, I am not surprised that there was a little of a mixed vote, but very thrilled that overall we decided to move forward.
And for people that haven't followed this closely, here are the schools that will get new names: Finnegan Elementary, Stonewall Jackson Elementary, Jefferson Davis Middle, Kirby Smith Middle, Jeb Stuart Middle, and Lee High School. That's been the most prominent conversation, what to do about Lee High, named after the Confederate general, of course. It will become Riverside High. And, you know, for months now, Rachel, we've heard the discussion about this and the division in the community over this process. For those who were opposed to the renaming, what's your message to those folks who really, they just honestly didn't seem to understand why these names were so offensive and so painful for African-Americans in particular, but not just African-Americans in this community?
Absolutely. Well, first, let me just say how extremely proud I am that our community has taken this very important step forward. It is a huge victory for education equity. It sends a clear message about who we want to be as a community going forward. And I'm really grateful to the school board and to Dr. Green for their leadership in solidifying this decision. I do believe that the community polling votes on the issue were an important factor in the final decision by the school board. We did see through that process that community engagement was off the chart. At Lee High School, the most controversial decision, we had more than 6,500 votes alone, and of that, 500 students voted. 84% of them voted to change the name. I want to say to those who are still tentative or not understanding that, you know, really the time is now for us to move forward, to really heal, and to really understand how important it is for us to learn from our collective history together, but to move forward in the best manner possible for our students. For us at JPEF, when we sort of shared our correspondence with the school board about this, we just talked about how important it is, one, to make sure that our learning environments to support the social, emotional, and cognitive needs of our students. And that includes making sure that there is a sense, that they do have a sense of belonging in their school. It really matters to their motivation to work hard and to succeed. And it's also really important that we value student voice when making these decisions.
Let's talk about three more schools that are not going to be renamed, although the original recommendation was to rename them. Rebalt Middle School, Rebalt High School, and Andrew Jackson High will keep their names. Of course, this town is named after Andrew Jackson. He was responsible for the Trail of Tears and the Native American genocide. The vote on the school board to keep Jackson High was close, only 4-3 in favor. However, there was a big groundswell of support across this community to keep Rebalt on the middle and high school names. He was the French Huguenot who first came to this community hundreds of years ago, and supporters of keeping Rebalt said he never harmed Native Americans, Indigenous people. What are your thoughts about this element of the whole process?
Yeah, it's a good question, and as we saw last night, the community's vote was very close on Andrew Jackson. The school board was close on Andrew Jackson as well. You know, the first thing I'll say is the issue, this whole conversation really started with the six schools that are named for Confederates during a very particular moment in history, the horrendous murder, I should say, of George Floyd, a black man at the hands of Derek Chauvin, a white police officer, and the movement for racial justice, particularly for African Americans in this country. It been expanded to encompass the other three schools named for controversial figures, but without Confederate ties. And I think the community input process definitely showed that Jacksonville was ready for change on the specific issue of moving away from glorifying the history of the Confederacy. There was clear consensus on the school board last night as well around those Confederate named schools. And if and when we do a school name change process again, I think we'll definitely be learning from the process as well. I fully anticipate, even based on the feedback that was provided at last night's meeting, that for Andrew Jackson in particular, there's a lot of support for changing that name. So I think that conversation will very much continue.
Now, your organization, the Jacksonville Public Education Fund, has been working to raise funds to pay for the costs of these name changes, new signage, new uniforms and such. It's estimated that it will cost the district a little over $1 million. How's that whole process going?
We've actually been really encouraged by the process so far. For the school renaming fund, more than $28,000 has been given by about 180 donors. Our site showed about 18,000, and then the district has directly received $10,000. And in addition to that, Dolores Barr Weaver, one of our community's most generous philanthropists, has issued a 2-to-1 matching challenge where she's providing $50,000 as the community contributes $100,000. And we're really grateful to all the community members who have stepped forward even before the vote. I'd like to share that, you know, adding to this, there also have been two significant in-kind contributions of athletic uniforms for all six Confederate named schools, and those are being provided by anonymous donors, with the total value of those generous gifts being about $317,000 or so. And as Dr. Green has explained, the district is committed to supporting this effort as a public-private partnership as well, but using non-tax revenue source to chip in. And through the district's beverage contract, $202,000 will be provided.
Okay.
Again, those are non-tax dollars. So overall, we're in pretty good shape, making good progress, and still need to raise about $250,000.
All righty. And already getting emails about this, people wanting to know about the matching gift from Mrs. Weaver, how people can donate to that fund.
Oh, please. I want to tell every listener, you can and should give now at JaxPef, that's JaxPef.org/renaming. Now that we have this decisive vote from the school board, we really want our community to step up and chip in.
All right. Let's go to your calls now as we speak with Rachel Tutwiler-Fortune, president at the Jacksonville Public Education Fund. It's official, everyone. Those local schools named after Confederate figures are getting new names. 549-2937, Susie in Mandarin. Hi, Susie. Good morning.
Hi, thank you, first-time caller. I just wanted to say that I'm very happy with the vote. I'm a little disappointed that my representative Hershey voted no, and that her reasoning seemed to be where the money was coming from when it was clearly stated that it would be privately funded. I will personally be making a donation today, and I do hope that they can revisit Andrew Jackson. Thank you.
Thank you. We're getting comments about the no votes from the school board on our Facebook page, Rachel. Here's one from a listener. I think board members Charlotte Joyce and Lori Hershey should resign after their votes. Can you, let's talk a little bit, though, about why these board members voted the way they did based on their comments. Can you give us a little insight into that?
Sure. As you already mentioned, Melissa, there was some concern about how the renaming effort would be funded. However, we feel very good that we can continue to make really great progress as a community on that. And the other chief concern that was expressed was about the process itself, just some concerns about whether it was fully transparent and, you know, effectively run. And so, you know, happy to sort of, you know, share any comments on that if that's helpful. But those were the two components, the voting process not being, quote, transparent and biased, and the cost itself.
We are getting calls about that. Tom has a comment on the West Side about how the voting was conducted. Tom, good morning.
Yes, ma'am. Like I said when they screened me, Joyce really was obsessed with the voting irregularities that she cited at particularly Robert E. Lee. And it needs to be pointed out that the voting irregularities at Robert E. Lee really went the other way in the majority. Originally, the students were told that they would be voting by class, and instead the process became the students had to ask for permission, get a pass to go vote, and then be escorted to and from the vote. All this during finals. So you see that with really an unrealistic way for them to get to the vote. And on top of that, you can even look at the removal of Amy Donofrio from the classroom as an attempt to take away the leadership of the student community at the school. So I think Joyce, if she wants to talk about voting irregularities, needs to look at both sides rather than just one.
Okay, Tom, thank you. So let's talk about this, Rachel, how the vote was conducted. And then also that caller, Tom, mentioned a teacher, Miss Donofrio at Lee High School, who has basically been put on leave for an undetermined period of time because she would not remove a Black Lives Matter flag from her classroom. Let's begin, though, with the voting questions. Can you share a little bit about how that whole process was conducted?
Sure. On the process itself, the school board basically put in their sort of expectations that the process would include significant stakeholder input, then for there to be a recommendation from the superintendent, Dr. Green, for the school board to make the final decision as we saw play out last night. And, you know, as it relates to just the concerns around, you know, whether this was a fully transparent process or bias, you know, hear those concerns. You know, I think in particular last night, there were some questions about approximately 150 votes at Lee High School. You know, big picture, however, it's really important to note that there were a total of 6,500 votes at that particular school. So this number wouldn't have even affected the outcome. And the voting wasn't, you know, a decisive factor. It was meant as input into the superintendent's recommendation, just like all the community meetings and public comments were. I really believe board member Warren Jones said it best last night when this issue came up. He basically said, you know, where was the community input for the naming of the schools in the first place? These schools were named during Jim Crow, school segregation, racial terror lynchings. And there wasn't even African-American representation on our elected bodies when these schools were named. So we can't forget that the community has spoken more clearly now than ever. And it's very important for us to consider that feedback and move forward as we have.
Lots of comments on Facebook. Here's one from Hope. This really wasn't a difficult decision. The bloated and extended process put the pressure on the community instead of leaders leading. Community input is appropriate, but a year of debates about the facts of history is absurd. I appreciate Warren Jones's leadership, but it was people power that brought this to fruition. Another comment from Siobhan. This was an expensive and an unnecessarily theatrical display in the name of fairness to folks who would rather still fight for the lost cause than do the right thing for the students and citizens of Jacksonville. Rachel Tutwiler Fortune, the myth of the lost cause, that narrative in the South over the causes of the Civil War and the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. People have been laboring under a false narrative in this country for 150 years. And so what about this incredibly painstaking process in this city to get this done? Do you agree with some of these listeners that maybe it was a little too laborious?
Yeah, I'll be 100% honest. I do think the process was longer than would be desirable. And I appreciate, I heard last night the school board chair even apologize that the process was as long as it was. My hope is that as we move forward, we can learn from it and make sure that we reconfigure how this process works so that, you know, the next time around, things can be handled a lot more efficiently. I think it was important for the community to be able to provide some input. But there is definitely a more efficient way to go about doing that.
Lots of tweets. Here's one. Steps toward progress. Changing the names was supported by the Chamber of Commerce and many other groups. Good for business, good for students. Here's another tweet. Here's what matters most. The students were in favor of the changes, and they spoke passionately about why these changes were necessary. Let's examine that a bit, Rachel. Particularly at Lee High School, the school named after the Confederate general, which now is a majority African-American student body. The kids, this is the only high school in the mix here, the kids did speak quite eloquently about why they believed these names needed to change.
Absolutely. And, you know, JPEP was proud to be among partners at the PTA, the Chamber, the Interfaith Council, 90 Forward, the Florida Times Union Editorial Board, and others that supported changing the Confederate name schools. You know, as a research-led organization, of course, we were concerned about, you know, just the impact of this decision on student learning, but also we have a long history of putting student voice at the center of our work. And when it's clear that the students want change, we were 100% and are proud to be 100% behind them. I think, you know, our students have definitely demonstrated such commendable leadership in this process, and it's one of the things I'm most proud of, even though it was a laborious and challenging thing to be a part of.
We're speaking with Rachel Tutwiler Fortune, president of the Jacksonville Public Education Fund. If you're just tuning in, the vote is now official. Six local schools who were named after Confederate figures are getting new names. Those names will be in place at the start of the upcoming school year in August. Let's go to John on the South Side. Hi, John. Good morning.
Hey, Melissa. Yeah, this is John Barnes from the South Side. I just want to congratulate the hard work of Rachel JPEF and just the grassroots organizations. You know, we talk about the chamber, we talk about these different folks, but this is such a win for that person in your car who's driving to work and feeling discouraged and hearing about all the stuff that's happened the last year. You know, when we have the right leaders in place, people in nonprofits, people in organizations like JPEF, like Rachel Tutwiler, you know, it gives Jacksonville the chance to truly stand united and move forward. And I this is a morning to celebrate. I'm lifting my coffee cup to you guys this morning. So thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure, John. Thank you. Rachel, on a personal note, this has to be a happy day for you. You have worked very hard on this. As you said, you are a native of Jacksonville. You, along with Superintendent Dr. Diana Green, the CEO of 90 Forward, all African-American women who have led on this whole process.
Absolutely. Well, and I'm just proud to be among such incredible partners. I appreciate John for those very kind remarks. I also just extend heartfelt gratitude to all of the grassroots activists who I believe have been, you know, front and center, really making sure that this conversation did not lose momentum every step of the way. And so the Northside Coalition, the NAACP, mm-hmm. they're just so, the Take 'Em Down Jacks organization, so many organizations.
Yes, I didn't mean to leave them out. They were involved too, very heavily, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, and speaking of that, okay, so the names are coming down off these schools. The Confederate statues, that was the first wave of this in Jacksonville, when we saw the removal in particular of the statue of Heming in the former Heming Park downtown. Some of the statues, though, around town, they've been covered up, but they still haven't been removed. So this whole process, honestly, isn't quite over yet in this city.
You're absolutely right. And I think if the school board vote can, you know, help us just understand just how ready the community is to move forward, we need to go back and make sure, as you mentioned, this started last year with the statues. It's been about a year now since these conversations began, so we need to go ahead and get them removed.
And a previous listener on Twitter pointed out that this is something the business community strongly desires. Having these remnants of the Confederacy lingering on parks and place names and schools, it's not good for business in the 21st century. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. I mean, I've had some conversations about this with various, you know, business partners who really understand, you know, just how attractive it is for businesses who are considering coming to Jacksonville to see, you know, just how, you know, inclusive this city is, how, you know, committed we are to making sure that there's every available opportunity. It really just shows that we are progressive in our thinking and we're prepared to move forward. And that's good for business. It has economic benefits as well for every resident.
And again, if you're wondering how to donate to the matching fund on the renaming costs that has been set up by Dolores Barr Weaver, as Rachel said, go to jaxpef.org. That's for Jacksonville Public Education Fund. jaxpef.org/renaming. And Rachel Tutwiler Fortune, always good to get you on the program. She is president of JPEF. And congratulations. I know it's been a long effort for many folks. So thanks for sharing your thoughts with us at the conclusion.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
And much more still ahead later in the hour. Some good news for your midweek in our What's Good Wednesdays. That's later, but up next.
We have a sense of urgency to be able to implement this in Jacksonville and across the state.
Project Opioid kicks off in the city, a new effort to combat opiate overdoses in Duval. We'll tell you who's behind it next. Throughout this time of pandemic, other medical emergencies have often been pushed to the back burner of our consciousness. That includes the opioid epidemic, which has shown no signs of slowing down. In fact, the crisis has only gotten worse through this challenging last year. Here's some good news. Jacksonville is one of five regions in Florida included in the expansion of Project Opioid. It's a Central Florida-based coalition created to confront the opiate overdose crisis in communities across the state. This is a joint project of the Florida Blue Foundation and the Jacks Chamber here in our area. And I learned more from the program's advocacy director, TJ Ward. TJ, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity.
So tell us a little bit more about Project Opioid. This is spreading across Florida, including here in Jacksonville, to confront the opiate overdose crisis around the state. Tell us about your role and what this is hoping to accomplish.
Yes, so Project Opioid was something that originated in Central Florida as a result of a conversation between Pat Garrity of Florida Blue and Andre Bailey, who founded Project Opioid. And they were talking about what they could do together to confront this overdose crisis that was occurring back in 2018. And as you know, it's become worse as a result of everything that occurred in 2020. And so we have a sense of urgency to be able to implement this in Jacksonville and across the state. There are six regions that are implementing the initiative. And so what we hope to do ultimately is save lives, is to decrease the amount of overdose deaths that are occurring in the state of Florida.
And as you mentioned, the pandemic has only made this crisis worse. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. It's intensified it beyond what we could have ever imagined. If you think about the isolation that occurred, and obviously some of that, you know, was necessary to be able to get everything under control, but it still caused issues with people who were used to being able to get treatment, certain types of treatment. They no longer had access to that, as well as, you know, people who weren't using began using during the pandemic. If you think about the loneliness, the depression, the anxiety, all of those things that came about as a result of just the isolation that occurred, people started handling those issues by turning to, you know, drugs and overdosing, you know, at a rapid rate, again, to the point that we could have never imagined. And also in relation to the increase that's occurred, fentanyl is really a large contributor. Mm-hmm. This illicit opioid, this, you know, synthetic opioid that has been included in everybody's drug of choice now, has really caused a massive amount of overdose deaths. And so those combined factors have really caused the whole overdose epidemic and caused the statistics, the numbers of people that are dying just to skyrocket.
Right. And so then how will the money coming from the Florida Blue Foundation to support this initiative, tell us how these dollars will be used and the types of things you'll be leading here in Jacksonville to turn these numbers around?
Absolutely. So we are in the coalition building stage, and we are really just assembling influential leaders within our community from all different sectors. And so we're seeing people join our coalition from government, education, lots of nonprofit service providers, healthcare, public safety. But we're also really focused on getting business leaders, faith leaders, and philanthropic leaders in our coalition, because we know they possess some of the unique abilities and platforms to be able to raise awareness and to be able to bring some resources and a skill set, really a problem-solving skill set that can make a huge difference in this. And so some of the things we're doing in the beginning stages are building the coalition, increasing awareness, because some people still are not understanding, you know, the effect that this has had on our community. We also are creating and sharing data that will help people just kind of wrap their mind around the issue that has occurred and is still occurring. And then we want to formulate some high-impact strategies, some things that we can do in addition to some of the quick action steps that are already occurring. And let me just say as well that there are so many frontline leaders and service providers that are doing a great job, you know, at helping people in need. We just want to come alongside them and perhaps maybe tap into, you know, some leadership that isn't yet involved maybe aren't in the conversation, and really leverage the influence and the impact that they have to make a difference in this. So we want to assemble those leaders, come up with some strategies that can really make a difference, and then coordinate between stakeholders. So just bring people together and help them understand what is going on within the community to be able to utilize, you know, all of the things that we have at our disposal in an effective way.
Right. I mean, with this coalition you're building, the goal is pretty ambitious. You want to reduce opiate overdoses and deaths in this region by 50% in the next 3 years, correct?
That is correct.
That's a tough goal to meet, but you got to set the bar high to try to save more lives.
Well, and that's the idea behind it. You know, shoot for the stars, and whatever impact we can make and whatever difference we can make is going to be better than what it was before. But we feel like because of the unique perspective that business leaders and faith leaders bring to this and the unique platform that they have, that we really can make a difference and make an impact as far as this is concerned.
Well, we will definitely be following this closely. Thank you so much, TJ. He'll be leading Project Opioid here in Jacksonville through the Jacks Chamber and with funds from the Florida Blue Foundation. We'll check back in with you as this proceeds. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, and look forward to the opportunity to update you in the future.
Pride Month, and to celebrate it, Mocha Jacksonville is playing host this week to the Many Sides of Pride Film Festival. It's presented by the LGBTQ Community Fund for Northeast Florida. Now, the festival celebrates the best in LGBTQ film, along with programs featuring nationally renowned directors and performers, all in celebration of this community's extraordinary impact on the world of cinema. With more, we welcome Manuel Velasquez, Director of Student Affairs at the UNF LGBTQ Resource Center. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to talk to you. And Dr. Joe Barton, President of the LGBTQ Community Fund Advisory Board. Hey, Dr. Barton.
Good morning.
Well, this is exciting, and it's great to see that Mocha is hosting the film festival. Tell us a little bit about the Many Sides of Pride Film Fest.
Well, the film festival begins on June 3rd, which is Thursday, and it'll go on until June 6th. It's a festival that is open, and it's free to everybody. I must say that tickets for the in-person viewings are almost sold out.
Okay.
But the entire festival can also be seen virtually through the website. So anybody who wants to go in and be able to view it, they can view it from the comfort of their own home or come into the Mocha and be able to view them. But you do have to register ahead of time for them.
And that's at mochajacksonville.org. We'll give that website again. And this is presented by your fund. Tell us about it, Dr. Barton.
Well, the LGBTQ Community Fund for Northeast Florida was created so that generous individuals could collectively pool their charitable gifts and really to help support the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer questioning community. This is an advised fund. It's housed at the Community Foundation for Northeast Florida. It was established in 2014 and really spent the 2 years of research and knowledge building around the needs of the LGBTQ members of our community. The fund has given more than $750,000 in grants to nonprofits in Northeast Florida. And over the years, we've just really felt like we've been able to make an impact locally to a lot of these organizations. It's pretty exciting to see some of the programs that they've incorporated into their organizations. Jasmine, for example, has done a lot of servicing for LGBTQ homeless youth. UNF LGBT Resource Center has created a mentoring program at UNF called the Club Can Do. Elder Source has done some great sensitivity training for caregivers to the elderly. PFLAG is another example that we've helped support their strategic planning. And then one of the most recent projects that we've funded a grant for is MOCA with the Many Sides of Pride Film Festival. So I really feel like we're starting to have a real impact into the community with some of the grants that we've provided.
And this festival is an extension of that. Why do you feel it was important to stage a festival focused on this community?
Well, we did the research project using the Williams Institute to determine some of the needs of the community. And one of the things that we came up with was to show the visibility and the impact that the LGBT community has had. And so this has given us an opportunity to really showcase and bring awareness and visibility to what work is being done in our community. MOCA has a capacity to put on this event and adds credibility to the project. The team at MOCA is very talented and creative. They have access to a lot of resources to really make this a great success. So we really feel that this is going to bring an awareness to everyone in the community, you know, our straight allies as well as the LGBTQ members, to really show what can be done through the nonprofit sector.
All right, let's go to Manny Velasquez now at UNF. As we heard from Dr. Barton, Manuel, the films are selling out quickly, but there's more happening at this festival than just the screening of the movies. Tell us what else people can participate in.
Yes, definitely. It is going to be a fun-filled few days. You know, we haven't had anything like this in Jacksonville for about 20 years, I believe. Yes, we do have a lot of different films that are going on, but there are also some amazing panel discussions that are going to take place. We've got some Q&As with some of the directors. For example, Kareem Tash, who is the director of Mucho Mucho Amor, The Life of Walter Mercado, is going to be in person at MOCA on Friday night. And we've also got some other panel discussions that are that deal with topics that are extremely challenging for the LGBTQ community, such as The Gray Area, which is based on the Gray Area film, which is a film that explores how Western cultures respond to masculine women, how that can be damaging, some of the ramifications can be damaging. Of course, it also talks about the diversity issues or the lack thereof within the field of film and production. So we're bringing a lot of different kinds of awareness. In addition to all of those amazing discussions, we are going to be having some really fun events. For example, on Sunday, as I'm calling it, Sunday is going to be a drag day because we're going to start off with a drag queen brunch at 11 a.m. at the main library right next to MOCA. And we've got a RuPaul's Drag Race All-Star winner, season 4, Trinity the Tuck, who is going to be our main MC and the main diva for the event, alongside some of the top queens in Jacksonville, such as Carissa Way, Cinnamon LaRoche, the Lady Visaya. It's going to be an amazing fun day. And then to close off the evening, we're going to have a drag review celebrating the film The Adventures of Priscilla, the Queen of the Desert, and that's featuring Jacksonville's own BB Deluxe. So it's going to be an amazing, fun-filled weekend, which I think we all need at this point after the year we've had. I think it's necessary for us to be able to be part of that community and to experience that community feeling again. You know, hopefully most of us are vaccinated, so it's a good thing. So it's going to be fun.
Now, this is free to all, this festival. You don't have to pay for tickets. It is a hybrid festival, Manny Velasquez. People can stream it or they can attend in person, yes?
That is correct. And we do ask people to register so that they can either get the tickets or be able to get the codes so they can view them online as well.
I'll say this website again in a minute, but to register, it's mochajacksonville.unf.edu.
Correct.
Dr. Barton, you know, I don't think it can be said enough how the LGBT community has contributed to the arts. So this festival is a recognition of that, among many other things.
It is. And, you know, we have some local celebrities that are being featured in this film festival as well. Hurley Haywood, who is a legendary race car driver. The opening film is a documentary of his life, and that's going to be pretty exciting. He's going to be at the MOCA live with the director to have a discussion afterwards. And so it really gives us an opportunity to showcase, you know, filmmakers and artists, you know, and people in our community as well of what they've done. You know, the needs are really great, and it's just nice to be able to see us come together to put on an event like this. I know we've talked about it being a free event. There are opportunities when you register to make a donation. We always welcome additional financial support so we can continue to put on programs like this in the future. But it's just nice to be able to support, you know, our community and our local artists for these types of events.
Now, in the first segment, we talked about this community moving ahead by tossing aside Confederate names on schools. When it comes to the LGBTQ community in Jacksonville and inclusiveness and acceptance, this town has come a long way there, too. Could you both share your thoughts about how that has evolved over the years, beginning with Dr. Barton?
Sure. You know, I was involved with some of the HRO issues that we dealt with the first time that it didn't pass, and the second time, thank goodness that it did pass. You know, from my own experience of being a business owner and a professional in the community, you know, for the first half of my career, just really was very quiet about that because I just didn't feel that the community was very accepting. And it, since that time, you know, I've been involved in philanthropy and in a lot of organizations and have really seen the whole attitude start to change. And I think part of that is just education. People weren't aware of what is transgender, what is, you know, what do these different letters of this alphabet LGBTQ stand for, and what does that mean for each of these individuals? So I think part of it is just educating our community of what these stand for and what these youth and adults in our community need and where the needs are. It's come a long way. There's still a lot of, I'm going to say, prejudice attitudes that I think still need to change. But I think putting on events like this and showcasing, you know, the talents of our community, and by supporting a lot of these local nonprofits, we've really started to raise an awareness in this community that what an impact, like you said, not only artists have, but also other people who've worked diligently in our community to make it a better place. So I think we've come a long ways. I do think we have a long ways to go, but I'm just glad to be a part of the process and to continue to open people's eyes to what the possibilities are.
And again, mochajacksonville.unf.edu to register. With just a minute left, Manny, your thoughts.
I've only been a resident of Jacksonville for a little bit over a year and 4 months. And one of the things that I, you know, when I first moved to Jacksonville, I wanted to make sure that I was going to be in a place where I felt included, that my family felt safe, because I came from New York where we had a lot of different laws.
And we're almost out of time. sorry to cut you off. I'm glad to hear that you do feel that. And mochajacksonville.unf.edu. Check out the film festival, everyone, in celebration of Pride Month, the Many Sides of Pride Film Fest. And gentlemen, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be right back.
Florida Polytechnic University, ranked nationally as a top 40 public undergraduate engineering college by U.S. News & World Report, offering master's degree tracks in robotics, engineering management, and data science. More at floridapoly.edu.
Hey, I'm Rick Steves, host of Travel with Rick Steves. Join me virtually Thursday, June 17th at 7 p.m. as I join WJCT Public Media's president, David McGowan, for an evening of travel conversation. Visit wjct.org/events to register.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Look up into the night sky and you just might see a long line of mysterious lights swiftly flying by. We're pretty sure it's not an alien invasion. Elon Musk's new Starlink satellites are supposed to bring high-speed internet to rural areas, but some astronomers, they're annoyed. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, the sharp racial distinctions in the way Americans' Second Amendment right to bear arms has been applied. Historian Carol Anderson says the amendment was crafted to ensure slave owners could suppress rebellions, and black people have often been denied the right to use guns in self-defense, with tragic consequences. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Half of all American adults are fully vaccinated, and that means companies big and small are wondering what to do about remote work. 40% of Americans want a mix of in-person and out-of-office employment, but what would that look like, and is it really viable? Should we stay or should we go? The future of remote work, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, summer is here and the blueberries are ripe for the picking. So says our occasional contributor, Mike Favo. Take a listen.
Everyone has their first official sign of summer, an event or moment demonstrating that summer has arrived. For some, it is the graduation parties. For others, it's professional baseball games. For Trevor Lawrence and Tim Tebow, it was Jaguars minicamp. And for me, it is picking blueberries. I absolutely love pick-your-own-blueberry season. The sights, the sounds, the sensations, everything about it appeals to me. I've been picking in patches every one of my 15 years in Jacksonville, and I will never tire of it. This Memorial Day weekend, my family and I head out for our first harvest of 2021. Typically, we arrive at the blueberry farm at dawn, while the bushes and berries are still soaked with dew. After about 15 minutes, my shirt is soaked with dew and my bucket is filling with berries. It is peaceful in the patch, yet not silent, as every sound of nature waking up sings and soothes. Before long, the sounds of human nature join in with the laughter and glee of children. While I pick, I eavesdrop as nearby parents expertly coach their young ones on which to pick and which to leave, along with an admonishment that more berries need to go in the bucket than go in their mouths. I also enjoy overhearing the conversations of blueberry plans. Muffins, pies, smoothies, in yogurt, on cornflakes, and my daughter's personal favorite, blueberry crisp, fresh from the oven. Which I must admit, she has become especially skilled at baking over the years. Visions of blueberry crisp provide the motivation to me to get out of bed at 5:45 a.m. on a sleep-in Saturday. The annual season begins at the end of May and closes towards the end of June. After my first few years of picking, my addiction grew so much that once a week on Saturdays was not enough time in the patch for me. So I began taking Friday mornings off from work. I could hit the patch for a quick 90 minutes and still be on time for the mid-morning meeting. The first time I put this on my schedule, I received some raised eyebrows and questioning looks from coworkers. When I arrived at the meeting with 4 pounds of berries to share, their skepticism disappeared, as did most of the berries. Like all addicts, I am an obnoxious advocate for everyone else to join me. Despite the risk of inviting more competition for the best berries, I still encourage friends, family, strangers in the public's produce section, baristas at the drive-thru window, and even the telemarketers who call at the worst moment possible to convince me to extend my car warranty. I insist to one and all that they should join us at the crack of dawn on a Saturday morning to fill a bucket with plump, juicy blueberries. I cannot explain my behavior except to say that it brings me joy and peace that I want to share it with others. Summer is here, and so are the blueberries. Grab your kids or grandkids. I'll see you in the patch.
And last but not least, it's Wednesday, time to take a look at what's good around town. Well, it's June, the month of weddings, summer break, and sadly, the kickoff of hurricane season. But here's some positive news. Beginning this Friday, you will not only be able to listen to this program, you'll be able to watch our Friday roundtable each week. Just log on to WJCT's YouTube page or the First Coast Connect Facebook page every Friday at 9 a.m. Grab a cup of coffee and enjoy the live stream. Not only that, Jack's PBS Passport subscribers can also watch it on demand shortly after it airs live. Again, go to our Facebook page or our YouTube page. Well, Jacksonville's a hidden gem for car enthusiasts, and this year, the annual Highway to Help Heroes charity drive is adding to the tradition. It's coming up this Saturday. 100 supercars will cruise up I-95 and Florida's historic A1A Coastal Highway to benefit injured and fallen police officers and veterans. Check that out this weekend. Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens is hosting an all-new event, the Illuma Zoo Summer Spectacle. It starts Friday, and it runs every Friday through the end of August. Everything gets going after the zoo closes at 6 p.m. and the sun goes down. You can beat the heat, enjoy the gardens, and see the animals until 30 minutes before sunset. And then as the light fades, a fantasy landscape of nature will emerge with illuminated scenes, color, animation, stilt walkers, fire spinners, all kinds of displays, live music, culinary creations, refreshing adult beverages, and even some limited edition gifts available for purchase. Sounds pretty cool. Now, check out Illuma Zoo by getting $20 tickets for zoo members, $25 for non-members. Kids under 2 are free. All tickets include access to the wildlife carousel for guests 12 and under. And you can get those tickets online in advance at jacksonvillezoo.org/Illuma Zoo. And that kicks off Friday. And for more good news delivered straight to your inbox, sign up for our What's Good Wednesdays newsletter at WJCT.org. It goes out later today. And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, too, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Keep those emails coming. We appreciate your feedback. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and catch our podcast up later today wherever you like to listen. You can also listen right through the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Wednesday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.